It's Wednesday, October 10th, 2018, and this is KBIA's News of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are my colleagues, Mike McKean and Ernest Perry.
How you doing?
On our program this week, the deaths of Jamal Khashoggi in Turkey and Victoria Maranova in Bulgaria. We'll talk about the circumstances of each of those cases. We're also going to look at the confirmation of now Associate Justice Brett Kavanaugh and why some say the media's potential mishandling of that story played a role in handing President Trump a victory. And where America streams, we'll talk about Walmart's venture into video streaming and television programming. There's a lot more that hopefully we'll get to before our half hour is up today, but I want to start with a quote from Washington Post media columnist Margaret Sullivan. Monday, she wrote that after a week of dire news, the certainty of our ruptured nation, the likelihood of a journalist being murdered, the United Nations report on climate change was, for some people, a bridge too far. What was in that report? The frightening prediction that by 2040, only 22 years from now, we could be looking at food shortages, wildfires, and the mass deaths of coral reefs. All the result of climate change. These headlines, they were pretty alarmist. The BBC, for instance, writing that this is the final call to save the world from climate catastrophe.
Yeah, I mean, it's depressing, maybe even debilitating to a certain extent for journalists and just all the rest of us as well. I mean, I talked about this story with students in my class earlier this week, and basically they started out saying, do we have to talk about this? There's nothing that we can do. People will not change their behaviors. What do you expect of us as journalists? I mean, it's such a difficult topic, and the likelihood of successfully doing much about it is so far off that I think a lot of folks are just depressed.
Yeah, one of the things that I admire Margaret Sullivan in her column about that was that she said this should be the number one and most sustained topic for journalists from here until forever. But she also said that's not going to happen. I mean, she was just being brutally honest and realistic about the fact that in many ways the media is culpable in this, because these are topics that we don't stay on. And this is crucial and it's vital. I mean, we're still arguing, 20, 30, in some cases 40 years since the United Nations came out and said that climate change is real. We're still arguing about whether or not climate change is real. And we've changed it from global warming to climate change so that it can say, well, it's changing or it's not changing, or it's changing in this way or not this way. I mean, we're still fooling around with the semantics of it and not dealing with the reality that we've got some problems.
I will say, though, and I applaud Margaret Sullivan for making this call to arms for journalists, but even she fell into the same trap that a lot of journalists do these days. She could not avoid, when she talked about this, having her cake and eating it too. She also referenced Donald Trump and Brent Kavanaugh and Taylor Swift and all kinds of other stuff in this piece when she could have focused entirely on the climate change story. But, you know, part of the problem is, what are we as journalists supposed to do differently? I mean, Amy and I were interviewing another group of our really bright students here yesterday for another reason and asked this question: how would you report this story so that it might make a difference? Well, I don't know. Could we humanize it more? Could we focus more on the local impacts of climate change? I mean, those are good ideas, but it's not like they haven't been tried. Mm-hmm. And I'm still wondering what we can do to contribute to a more useful conversation about this.
So do you think that this is an American problem and an American media problem? Or do you see the same patterns happening elsewhere around the globe?
I think it's around the globe. I don't think it's just an American problem. It is. You see it in Europe. You see it in Indonesia. Yeah. I was there, and they were talking about some of the issues that they're having, but they were reporting it in similar ways that we reported here. I mean, it's interesting that we're talking about this issue when a Category 4 storm is slated to hit the Florida coast within hours, and this is what's going to be the second or third storm to hit that part of the country just this hurricane season, and you've got all of these storms that come up. You have the wildfires out in California. You've got issues of not having enough cold weather in northern Canada.
The droughts that we've had here in the Midwest and in southern northern parts of Texas and the southern parts of the Midwest.
Absolutely, but we cover these stories, to get back to a point that you just made, yeah. Mike. We cover these stories as single incidents, and I don't think we do enough to link them together to start off saying, yes, this hurricane is coming. Yes, this has to do with climate change. I mean, I think that's one way we can do it, but it's got to be sustained.
I'll say, too, to answer your first question, I think that journalists in other parts of the world, and these are broad generalities, mm-hmm. sometimes do cover the story differently. On our Links blog, you posted a piece from the BBC and another one from The Guardian. And rather than going first and foremost to the political conflict, and is it Trump's fault or China's fault or India's fault, they laid out a really straightforward case of what the UN scientists had to say and what the impact would be. Does that mean they didn't talk about the politics? No. Does that mean American media didn't also sort of lay out the facts of climate change? No, but the focus, the initial focus, I think is a bit different. We tend to focus too much on the political ramifications or who's to blame and not enough on what, frankly, what the public could do. Because if you want to talk about how we're going to make a difference, yes, governments and corporations have got to change, but so do we.
And you know, it's little things. So the three of us have done some extensive traveling, and something that I notice when I'm in China or I'm in Kazakhstan or across Europe, this is even like the simplest thing. Something you don't see in many domestic hotels is that idea that you have to put your key in a little receptacle to turn on the electricity in the room, that in so many other parts of the world is now standard in order to have lights or air conditioning or heat, so that that energy isn't being expended on an empty room. Right. It's little things like that that start to make the bigger dent.
And the scientists that were quoted in this BBC version of the story, for example, were saying, here are some of the things that we have to stop mm-hmm. doing. Eating as much meat or milk or cheese, hanging our wet laundry out to dry on the line like our grandparents did. How many travel by train or instead of by plane? How many Americans today are really willing and able to do those
things? Yeah, that's going to be an issue.
And if that's not the impetus to get fast-paced or train rail here, I don't know what will be. So a little bit ago, when I referenced that quote from Margaret Sullivan, I read where she had written about a murdered journalist. She might have been referring to Bulgaria's Victoria Mironova, or she might have been referring to Jamal Khashoggi, a prominent Saudi writer who often published columns in the Washington Post. He vanished after entering the Saudi consulate in Istanbul to get some paperwork in order last Tuesday to marry his Turkish fiancée. He hasn't been seen or heard from since. There have been unsubstantiated reports that Turkish officials told the Washington Post that he was murdered while inside the consulate. The facts here are still very much muddied. It's unclear exactly what has been happening. But in the past, he's been very critical of the Saudi government in a lot of the columns that he's written, both for publications here in the United States and for others.
Yes, he's been very critical. This is not the first time that the Saudis have reached outside of their borders to go after people who they feel are not friendly to them. Mm-hmm. Dissidents they've gone after. They've gone after other journalists in the past. So this is not... this is not out of the norm for them in situations like this. At first I wasn't shocked that Turkey wasn't really saying much of anything, but now they've come out and basically said, yeah, something has definitely happened. They think he was murdered. Now they're saying that, you know, he may have been murdered inside the embassy and that his body may have been dismembered and that's why no one's seen him. I mean, there's so much that we don't know about what's going on here. But then the other side of that is, you know, in those initial days, the United States wasn't saying anything about what was going on and whether or not the Saudis were involved. Of course, they're a key ally of the United States. So.
And the United States not saying something could have...
emboldened,
but it had the United States come out stronger, could have had a very negative effect on that relationship. And some are saying that's why the U.S. was quiet for so long.
I don't know if with this particular incident of the U.S. government speaking up soon after he disappeared would have made any difference in that case. Mm-hmm. The fact that the president and the State Department have not really said very much when other journalists have been murdered. And of course, the attacks on journalists by the president himself may embolden others. I think the other thing that's really frustrating about this story with Khashoggi is that journalists are being very aggressive here in the U.S. and around the world to try to find out what happened. But they're forced to rely on Turkish media, right, which are forced to rely on government sources. I mean, who knows? We've had stories in the New York Times that there may have been a person who was an expert in conducting autopsies, right, who was part of a 15-member team that was flown in from Saudi Arabia with a bone saw. Then you have other people in the media there saying, well, maybe he was just kidnapped. So there's details that seem to point to very specific things that the intelligence agencies in Turkey know, but I don't know how we can, you know, prove
them. Yeah, I mean, and I think that's one of the most frustrating things for journalists around the world now, is that there seems to be this sort of pattern of journalists being attacked and governments not dealing with those issues in the way in which they did it in the past. And I think, and a lot of journalists are basically coming out and saying it's because the United States and the president of the United States now see the media as an enemy of the people, and it's created
devalued the work and
absolutely,
the profession.
Absolutely. And it's now basically gone from what's happening here domestically to what's going on internationally.
Well, so, and in Bulgaria, radio reports say that there's a man in jail taken into custody yesterday in connection with the rape and killing of television reporter Victoria Marinova. Her body was found over the weekend, and while authorities have not yet definitively tied her death to her investigative journalism, it is creating a shockwave across Europe as well, seeing as that she is the third journalist killed on that continent just this year.
Well, and so now the Bulgarian authorities are saying that the gentleman arrested in Germany for her murder was not, as far as they can tell, related to her reporting. But of course, they would say that, right, whether it's true or not. And the record in Bulgaria of the treatment of the press is pretty shocking compared to the rest of the EU. But as you said, there have been two other journalists who have been murdered, and it's pretty confident it was related to their work just since October of last year. So it seems to me there's a disturbing pattern, and I'm not really sure what kinds of protections are possible for journalists trying to do their jobs.
Yeah, I mean, and this one is really striking in the fact that she was, you know, she was more of a presenter, mm-hmm, right, as opposed to a actual investigative journalist. It's something that she was working toward, but she wasn't quite there yet. But she was almost, I guess, the equivalent of being an anchor here, right, in terms of presenting these stories in which other people had actually done the reporting and done the investigative work. But, I mean, to me, that just opens up the door for almost anyone who can be connected to any kind of investigative journalism.
Anybody who's face of investigative, absolutely, journalism is then at risk. Well, we have had no shortage of news here at home, too, including the story that has led this program for the past few weeks. So here it's taken us almost halfway through to get to it today, the confirmation of Judge Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court. Awaiting Friday's procedural vote, Susan Collins' floor speech, the Democrats' all-nighter, the actual vote, and then the secret swearing in, then 2 days later, that public swearing in. It felt like a really long, drawn-out process that was slow, and then slow, and then slow, and then happened almost like the Roadrunner in the Looney Tunes cartoons.
And the media's role in all of this is still up in the air. But I'll have to say, I mean, you've got different points of view, of course. Some believe that maybe news organizations didn't do enough. And a lot of other folks who say maybe we overplayed our hand. I don't know that it would have made any difference ultimately in whether or not he was confirmed. But certainly the way in which the reporters had to follow on with the release of the information a month and a half after Christine Blasey Ford sent in her letter to the Senate led to this narrative that journalists were just pawns for or willing conspirators with the Democrats. And now you see the president out there on the campaign trail, and he and Republicans believe they can use Kavanaugh's case to help them retain control of the Senate. So not only do I think journalists, if they tended to sympathize more with Blasey Ford than with Kavanaugh, not only did we not succeed in telling that story particularly well, we may, through our behavior, have handed the Republicans an opportunity to maintain their majority.
Yeah, I mean, you know, one of the things that bothered me about all of this coverage was that, you know, and I think we said this, I know for a fact we said this on the show, is that this was a done deal from day one that the president nominated Kavanaugh mm-hmm. for the position. I mean, everyone knew, including, you know, a lot of the senators who were sort of grandstanding throughout this process, knew that the votes were there and that ultimately he was going to become an associate justice of the Supreme Court. When we get to the point where we start to have these hearings and then the FBI investigation, I think Mike is absolutely right. All the media sort of gets into this, well, is this going to have an impact? Is it not going to have an impact? Is someone going to change their vote? Maybe they're not going to change their vote. What does the public think? Is this another Me Too moment? Or now all of a sudden it's a pushback on the part of white men against what they feel has been their victimization in all of this. And now instead of us presenting facts, we're drawn into these narratives that come from all sides of the political spectrum, and we seem to be manipulated. I don't say we, the media, are manipulated in this entire process. And in the end, we don't come out looking very well.
Yeah, and I do think it's fair for news organizations, for journalists to say there's no way that the FBI was going to be able to do a fulsome investigation of this case in the time they had or with the restrictions that the White House placed on them. But frankly, the FBI would have had a better chance and journalists would have had more of an opportunity to press that case if Blasey Ford's accusations had come out when she first made them mm-hmm. rather than when the Democrats were trying to throw it in as an 11th hour surprise.
I agree. I mean, part of this is that the way the information was released throughout the process, whether we're talking about for Blasey Ford's information or the investigation that the FBI did initially that the Democrats were claiming they didn't have full access to, all of that, the media was manipulated in this because of the way the information was released, both on the part of the Republicans and the Democrats. But in the end, you know, we wind up taking some of the blame for it. And this is classic Trump all the way throughout.
I would even say that once we got on the case as journalists, after the Blasey Ford allegations came out, after other allegations came out, journalists went into overdrive to try
and catch
cover
up.
That
yeah,
story.
They tried to,
but
yes. No, yeah.
You could argue that journalists and especially cable news outlets spent so much time reporting the allegations that seemed more credible and ones that seemed less credible that we didn't even spend time with other stories we should have been talking about.
Absolutely.
In more detail. A New York Times story on the Trump family fortune or the climate change story that just came out on Monday. We're still probably not spending as much time talking about that as we should because we're fixated on the Kavanaugh case.
Absolutely.
So we touched a little bit last week on the reporters who were showing their support for Dr. Ford during her testimony outwardly. And Mike, we've been talking again with the students we were talking about yesterday about where the line is, where we balance our independence and objectivity as journalists with the emotions that come naturally with being, well, human. Well, there are two television journalists who are finding themselves looking for work this week after their words and actions revealed their biases. Chris Long was an anchor at the CBS station in Palm Springs. On September 17th, he wrote on Facebook that, quote, "You are beyond dreaming if you think 17-year-old boys are not going to misbehave from time to time as they attempt relationships with the opposite sex. That is just the way animals are made." It then goes on to say that to allow someone to accuse a fellow teenager of some lesser miscreant behavior from some four decades ago is, I feel, meaning Long, a real stretch. And later he said that Dr. Ford's decision to wait to come forward until now, his words, stinks of political maneuvering. That post was deleted and replaced with an apology the next day. So maybe that was a moment of weakness. I'll ask Mike and Ernest in a second what they think about it. Maybe it was a tone-deaf expression of the personal, folksy side that television journalists are pressured to put out there these days. But then there's this. Jim Buhner. He used to work for KTTC in Rochester, Minnesota. That is, until he showed up to cover a Trump rally wearing a station jacket with its call letters visible, and one of those signature red Make America Great Again hats. The reporter in the Make America Great Again hat, that one's pretty cut and dry. Not shocked that he got fired.
I'd even say, well, I mean, it is cut and dry that he should have been fired mm-hmm. for doing what he did. However, there also appears to be evidence that he was sharing his own political beliefs about his support for the NRA and a lot of other things with his friends and even on social media before all this happened, if it weren't for the fact that another journalist in that market caught him wearing the MAGA hat, he might have gotten away with the station, might not have fired him. So I'm not sure that their decision to act quickly to get rid of him is all that covered in roses as we might think.
No, I agree. I mean, I remember when I first saw this story and I read it, that point that Mike just made is the first thing that popped into my head, is that they fired him because they got caught
by the Star Tribune,
not necessarily because they, you know, all of a sudden they became ethically wise to what was going on. I mean, he had been putting that out on social media for a while. And then when you go to the other example that you gave, I mean, again, we talked about this on the show over and over again. Just because you have a social media account doesn't give you, as a journalist, the opportunity just to put your thoughts out there and that not come back to become a problem for you in your journalism. Mm-hmm. So you have to be careful about how you do that.
And I'm not any more forgiving, frankly, of the California anchor who posted on Facebook and then put out his apology. I mean,
he put out his apology because he caught a lot of heat from people. That wasn't exactly the most, like, you know, I'm having this reflective moment and I'm going to apologize.
But even in the post itself, he tried to inoculate himself by saying, you know, sexual assault is always wrong, no matter what your age, and Me Too movement is a long time coming. But then he goes on, and I'm sorry, if you are an older white male journalist and you still fantasize about the good old days when you were in high school and the fun you had with girls, you probably should keep that to yourself or to your family and not share it with the public.
I agree with that.
Okay. So, and what can only be the most awkward segue ever, we're going to talk about bullying in schools. It's actually in the form of a really neat project that's being done right here in Mid-Missouri, a collaboration between a weekly publication called the Nemo News and the Columbia Missourian. What exactly did they go about doing here? People haven't had a chance to see it yet.
Well, I mean, what they did was the Nemo News had a reporter who, and it's a small community in northeast Missouri.
That's where Nemo comes from.
There was a shocking case of not just sexual assault, but bullying involving the middle school football team. And in this small community where everyone knows each other in some ways connected, at least from the stories that are coming out, the parents that were involved and parents who didn't know about it were trying to get information from the school district as to what's going on, who's investigating this, what did the investigation reveal, and the school district wouldn't say anything about it, wouldn't even talk about it in an open meeting. The reporter wrote the story, and the Columbia Missourian also went up and started writing stories to talk even more about the journalism involved, open records, open meetings, and how this can happen in a small community, and it becomes something that's so insular that it has generational damning effects on this community.
This may be one of the best examples of something we've been talking about for a long time, of just how valuable small town community journalism is and how endangered it is. Mm-hmm. This was abuse from older football players on younger football players, and the sheriff didn't want to answer questions about it. The school board wouldn't let parents ask questions about it at a school board meeting. When the Missourian finally did get involved in this and they called up to ask about it, they were told, well, contact the local paper. We've already spoken to them about it. So thank goodness for that Nemo News and the reporter there in Edina for covering this thing the way they did. Otherwise, this kind of problem would never have seen the light of day. Right. And those parents and those kids might never get any justice.
And I'm hoping that I believe that this is going to be an ongoing investigation, and it needs to be, because otherwise it'll get lost in all the other news that comes up, especially around election time.
Okay, so even as we talk about the importance of local journalism and national journalism too, some rather depressing news coming out of the Pew Research Center. Newsroom employees are on the very low end of the pay scale among college-educated adults in the U.S. You know, one of the jokes that I hear again and again is, working for this publication, we pay in prestige, or the work is just so meaningful, it doesn't matter that you're not making that much. You have enough to live on, so it's good enough. that makes it really hard for us to entice journalists and to keep them in the game far off after graduation.
And, you know, this has been a problem since we were young journalists, and it'll probably continue to be. It's exacerbated by the financial pressures that the media are feeling right now. But I don't know that you could even say, you know, with a straight face, you can live on this money. I mean, I don't know that you can. I mean, the salaries are so poor. We still have great students coming through the Missouri School of Journalism and journalism schools around the country.
And more motivated than ever.
They're very well motivated. They know that there are important stories they can tell. But how long can they continue to do that? Or how long can they build up sort of the knowledge base of what's going on if they think they have to move on to another profession in order to raise a family?
Well, and I think it's a part of it. I remember when I was in the business, one of the things that seemed to be moving toward that we're at now is when you go into journalism, you're basically a subcontractor for a larger organization because your salary is low, your benefits aren't all that great. You're doing it because you love you love the profession and you love what you're doing. And I think now we have a generation that still feels that way, but they also understand that they're going to have to do things differently. Journalism can't be the only thing that they can rely on in terms of building a career. They're going to have to supplement it with in other ways, and this is why building out that skill set is important.
And they're certainly not going to be able to stay in one place and move up through the ranks and retire from that place with a pension. Going to happen.
Right. And speaking of pensions, I mean, there are no pensions anymore. I mean, you know, even the state governments are trying to get out of the pension. So there you go.
Okay. Well, before we go, another streaming site that's making big moves, Vudu. It's not, and that's spelled V-U-D-U. It's not as popular as Netflix, Hulu, or Amazon, but it's ordering up a run of shows and movies from MGM library, and it'll be free. Vudu is owned by Walmart, so I guess you could say it's the place where America streams.
There's a niche. I mean, it looks like this program is mostly old programming offered for free. There's going to be advertising associated with it. It may not be the big upscale market that a place like Amazon or Netflix is aiming for, but there is a market. And if Walmart thinks there's a market for it, there's a market for it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, this is another instance in which you have these companies coming together to have these streaming operations. And it's one more thing that cable is going to have to compete with, that satellite, DirecTV, Dish TV are going to have to compete with as people sort of cut the cords.
Okay. Well, we have a little bit less than a minute before they're going to cut us off today. So I'd like to thank you for spending the last half hour with us. You can read more about the topics that we've talked about on our links blog. That's under the programs tab at kbia.org. Like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle there is @viewsonkbia. These are all great ways to watch and listen to our program again, to leave us comments and questions, see previews of what we'll be talking about next week, and more. Our thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan for directing today's show and to Aaron Hay for handling the audio. Tim Pilcher composed our original theme music, Ellie Fitzgerald, Kat Jennings, and Jared Ridgway, our social media producers. I'm Amy Simons. Be sure to join us again next week when we're back with you for another edition of Views of the News.